I think the extent to which the world is going to change over the next five is going to blow the past 40 away.
Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group, leading provider of commercial real estate intelligence. Here to provide you with the latest trends and news in the commercial real estate market. I'm excited to have a special guest on with me today, Bob Knackle of BK Real Estate Advisors. Bob, good to have you.
Cole, great to be with you today. Thanks for having me.
So, Bob, you're one of the most recognizable names in New York real estate. You have over four decades in the business. Personally brokered the sale of more than 2,300 buildings, totaling $22 billion in value. It's more than any other individual in New York history. Co-founded Massey Knackle Realty, which became one of the most successful investment sales firms before its sale to Cushman in 2014. Now you lead BK Real Estate Advisors. You're also a prolific writer and speaker. We're here to talk to you about some of your exciting views on zoning, air rights, property conversions. Really great to have you.
Yeah, great to be here. It's been a long road, but I have to say I feel so blessed that I got into a business that I consider my job and my hobby. And I have to say, after 42 years in the business, I'm more excited about what's going on today than ever. Feel I'm doing better than I ever have and love the business as much today as I did the day I got into it. So I feel very lucky, to say the least.
Excellent. We'll get into some of those topics a little later, but I want to hear your original story. I've heard it a couple of times, but you got into commercial real estate by accident. Do you want to tell our listeners what that was about?
Sure, completely by accident. I'll take you all the way back to 1981, a freshman at the Wharton School. I want to be the next Gordon Gekko, like every other Wharton kid, and take over Wall Street. And spring break freshman year, wanted to line up a summer job that would look good on my resume. So I went around to every commercial bank and investment bank in Bergen County, New Jersey, where I grew up, looking to get interviewed for a summer job. Came out of a Payne Weber office, and across the hall, I saw a Coldwell banker. And I walked into the place thinking it was a bank, dropped my resume off. They interviewed me later that day, or they called me later that day to set up an interview for the following day. And I set the interview up. This is, again, 1981. There's no internet. So I go to the library to look up this bank. And when I saw it was a real estate company, I'm like, oh shit, I don't want to go on this interview. I don't want to get into real estate. But they were the only ones hiring college kids for the summer. Took the job, loved it, went back my next two summers, and then started with CB in New York City when I got out of school in 1984. Complete serendipity that I got into this profession that I love so much, completely by accident.
So tell us a little about those early Massey Knackle days. I know the story probably continues from CB, but what was that like?
We started November 15th of 88. And the early days, you know, everything was very exciting. Every listing meant something. Every call meant something. It was a great time. And it was great for about 6 months. And then the S&L crisis started to kick in. And then we went through some very challenging times. We ran the business on credit cards for 3 or 4 years. I personally lived my life on credit cards for about 10 years. Fortunately, our love of the business never waned, and we always knew that we would succeed if we kept doing the right things over and over again. Fortunately, after a while, things started to kick in, and we made it through the S&L crisis, started to get a lot of bank business. The RTC was selling loans and we were selling buildings for banks that had failed. And there was a lot of that going on, 93, 94, 95. And that kind of pulled us out of it. But it was a challenge at first, but I don't remember being ever stressed or worrying about it. I just remember that it was always something that you went in, you did your best every day, went home at the end of the day, and then got a good night's rest and got up and did it all over again the next day.
It sounds like you learned a lot of lessons in those early days. What were some of the big ones that you still keep with you to this day?
Yeah, well, I think one of the big mistakes that we made was that Paul and I thought we knew everything. and didn't ask more senior people for help or more experienced people for help. Consequently, we made hundreds, if not thousands, of mistakes because we did everything by trial and error. And I wish we had, you know, seeked out the guidance and counsel of people who had been there and done that before. In later years, by 2007, we formed an executive advisory committee, and that really helped us in a lot of ways, helped us with the direction of the company and our initiatives, strategies, tactics, et cetera. But I'll tell you that doing things by trial and error is not the most effective way to get things done. I make too many mistakes. Fortunately, we didn't make a lot of those mistakes twice, but we did make a lot of mistakes that probably slowed our growth progression down significantly. But again, we were lucky we made it through.
So on the opposite side of that question is, what do you think made it so successful by the time it became a big kind of powerhouse firm?
No, clearly, I think one of the big things, and I still think it is one of the differentiating factors in the marketplace today, is market expertise. Back in those days, in the 80s and 90s, the amount of publicly available information was very minimal, and what was available was very opaque and inaccurate. We devised this territory system, put one agent in each neighborhood, and they got to really know everything about that neighborhood. So our market expertise was unparalleled. And so we knew each broker in their territory knew who was buying, who was selling, what zoning changes were affecting value, what average prices were, what tenants were moving into the area, what was impacting value. And we'd go into a client and say, yeah, we're a small popcorn stand, but we know this neighborhood better than anybody. And if you hire us, we can be a better advocate for you in terms of convincing buyers why they should pay a higher price than anybody else can. And that gained traction very rapidly. And again, we were a little shop operating only in New York City, competing against regional, national, and global companies. And from 2001, when CoStar started tracking the market, to 2014, when we sold the company to Cushman & Wakefield, the number two company in New York had sold about 1,300 buildings. We sold over 4,000. So we more than 3x'd the field for 14 years in a row. And it was really because of that local market expertise that we had. We knew more about the market than anybody else, and everyone knew it. And that's why the big global giants, 100,000 employees, big deal. We kick their ass all over the street, and anybody can do it. It's just a matter of grasping the market, understanding the market, and being able to articulate that market knowledge in a way that demonstrates that you know the market better than anybody and that you've helped other people before and you can help the next client. And I think that was really the key to our success.
Excellent. And I've got some questions about New York specifically a little later, but I do want to talk about those kind of early brokers. You know, I've heard you say that a number of the folks that you guys had at Massey Knackel have gone on to start their own teams, their own firms. Do you think it'd be different if they started out today?
I think that had we started Massey Knackel today on the same basis that we started it on in 1988, it wouldn't be nearly as successful. Because of the volume of publicly available data, having that local market expertise is not as important as it was. Today, I think that product specialization is much more important. To illustrate that, I always say brokers, I think, have two main assets, their market knowledge and their time. And you're always trying to improve and increase your market knowledge. But it's generally thought you can't make time. Time's finite. I disagree with that. I think you can effectively make time by using time more effectively. So as an example, if a generalist who sells all kinds of properties sold three buildings last week, an apartment building, a retail property, and an office building, and this week they're pitching an office building, that office building owner wants to hear everything about the office building you sold last week. Couldn't care less about the retail property you sold. But think if that broker had sold three office buildings last week and is pitching an office building this week. That owner wants to hear everything about everything you did last week. So you effectively just created time out of thin air. So that's why I think product specialization today matters so much, because it helps you to create time And everything you do every second of every day is accretive towards getting the next deal, helping the next client. Everything that you learned last week, every conversation you had, every experience that you had is going to help the next client. And so that's the way that you effectively create time. And I think that is the real method of succeeding in today's market. And as for the folks who, your original question was, would those folks do as well today? I think absolutely. And I will tell you that I'm very lucky. I have a lot to be proud of in my career. We sold the business in 2014 for $100 million. Paul and I started with just the two of us and an assistant in an 800 square foot sublet office. The big sale was a great thing. By far and away, my proudest legacy is that today in the New York City investment sales market, there are 33 companies or divisions of companies that are owned by or run by people that learn the business at Massey Knackel. And without a doubt, that's my proudest legacy. And, I'm trying to do the same thing at my new firm, BKREA, is a company that, I have several people who I know beyond the shadow of a doubt are going to have their own company someday or be running divisions of companies someday. And I really want to help get them there. And that'll just add to the legacy that I'm so very proud of.
Bob, let's talk a little about BKREA. Was there a particular market gap or some sort of need that you saw to create a new firm like that?
We actually started the new firm April 2nd of 24. And, with getting on this bandwagon, I talk a lot in public. I write a lot, but I do follow my own prescriptions. So when I say that product specialization is the key, I thought there was a big opportunity because of the changes that were going on within the New York City market. And the opportunity was that I've always sold a lot of land and development and redevelopment properties, but the market really has changed quite a bit. We have so much new legislation, City of Yes passed, Midtown South rezoning. We have a new tax abatement program for new construction called 485X. We have a new tax abatement program for conversion of non-residential buildings to residential called 467M. We have a new affordable housing program that replaced the old inclusionary housing program called UAP, the Universal Affordability Preference. We have different ways to transfer air rights from one parcel to another. New York City is an as-of-right zoning jurisdiction, so zoning tells you for every parcel what type of building it can be, how much building you can build, and what shape that building can have. And so all of these new things went into effect that completely changed the world. And so I kind of, in a way, Cole, feel like I'm starting over, but I started over with a 40-year track record behind me, which is very helpful. But I said, you know what, this development market, it's so convoluted. The labyrinth of our zoning resolution is so complicated that if you could grasp a lot of the concepts within that zoning resolution and be able to articulate them clearly to clients, that it really would be a competitive advantage. And to further that, we formed the first of its kind in-house BKREA policy and zoning SWAT team. So I have in-house, I have a zoning attorney, a zoning consultant, an architect, a policy guru, a data guy. And so we can dice and slice any property and within a day or two understand how to maximize the value of that property. And so what we've done is I've taken a 40-year track record of selling all kinds of properties and being a generalist, and I'm really focused on one segment of the market that involves three verticals that are highly correlated and synergistic. So if you think about it, a vacant building in New York, what can you do with it? One, you can knock it down and build a new building. Two, you can gut renovate the heck out of it and change its use from one use to another. Or three, you can sell it as a vacant building to a user that's going to occupy it for their own business. So that's what we do. We operate strictly in those three verticals. If it's anything outside of that box, we refer that to friends in the industry. And depending on who the client is, may continue to stay in tangentially or otherwise. But we're really focused on one thing and doing that one thing better than anybody else. And it has been extraordinarily beneficial to have that very specific skill set and be able to bring that to the market. It's enabled us to differentiate ourselves from every other broker. Every other broker that does land and development and redevelopment stuff in New York is a part-timer at it. We're full-timers at it. That makes a big difference. And as part of that process, you may be familiar with the NACL Map Room.
I've had the pleasure of visiting. It's incredible.
Yeah. So over the course of my career, I have won about 26% of my pitches. In the Map Room now, we've given 71 pitches. We've gotten 69 exclusive listings. That's a 97% win rate. And it just really shows that specialization, expertise, and unparalleled market knowledge really rule the day, because if you have those things going for you, you're going to produce a better result for the client.
So sounds like you guys really combine that traditional brokerage model built off your track record of 40 years with data research. Maybe you want to walk us through a deal that really married those two?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, we're selling a development site for a very large old-time New York family now on West 44th Street. And we pitched that business against four other firms. The other firms all came in and said, hey, this site is 60,000 buildable square feet. It's worth X, blah, blah, blah. We came in and said, hey, you have a great site here. It's got 74,000 buildable square feet. And they said, right, no, you're wrong. It's only 60,000 feet. We said, no, it appears to be 60,000, but it's really 74,000 feet because you own the property next door also. And in the Midtown zoning resolution, there's something called a compensating recess that you can grant by owning the adjacent property. You can grant that compensating recess to this property, which gives you the ability to fit more bulk inside your zoning envelope. Sure enough, we were right. We got the assignment. We're about to sign a contract on that building. But that's one where the expertise gave us such a competitive advantage that we easily won that business and demonstrated that we knew more about the zoning than anybody else. And when you're talking about more than a 20% increase in the buildable footage, that's basically 20% more on the price, even if everybody thought the price per foot was the same.
So I know that you've spoken a lot about AI and technology and how that's changing the business. I wonder if you have any views. Actually, I know you have views on what other parts of brokerage, AI or technology might be impacted.
Yeah, well, interestingly, there are two main ways that we're using AI technology today. And I will tell you, I'm so keenly aware of the importance of technology and AI. And, you know, to illustrate it, I think back to when I started in the CB days, we talked about 1984 as the start date. I came in, sat at my desk in 1984. I had no computer on my desk. I had no fax machine, no cell phone. We carried rolls of quarters around to make calls from payphones. Some of your listeners may not even know what a payphone is, but you think about how the world has changed over the last 40 years. I think the extent to which the world is going to change over the next five is going to blow the past 40 away. Technology is changing so rapidly. You know, we're using a piece of technology that came out 2 months ago, and we think, oh, this is the greatest thing in the world. And a new thing comes out that's bigger, stronger, faster, broader, more powerful. And the thing that came out 2 months ago is a dinosaur already. And this is happening month after month. It's changing so quickly. But there are two basic ways that we're using AI today. And when I started the new firm, the first person I hired was an AI guy. My COO, Seth Samowitz, is an AI guru. He started AI companies. He worked in driverless cars for 6 years. And I always joke that, hey, if this guy could make a car drive itself, he could help me sell a building. We're using AI in two ways. One is to make funneling processes more efficient and effective. You think about it, prospecting and deal execution are both funneling processes. We're going from thousands to hundreds to dozens to a few. And AI is beautiful to help make those processes more effective and efficient. Second way, which is probably the most powerful thing you can do with AI, but is going to be the most difficult for the industry to take advantage of is data interpretation. And why I say it's going to be the most difficult is that most data sets in real estate stink. You know, absolute numbers in our industry are very meaningless. For instance, if I tell you that in 2019 in Manhattan, there were $23.6 billion of sales volume, you probably have no idea what to think about that number. But if I tell you that at the peak of the market in 2015, it was $57.4 billion, and during the COVID year, 2020, it dropped to $11.1 billion, the 23.6 starts to have some feel to it. So I always say it's not the absolute numbers that matter. It's the relationship those numbers have to other numbers in a data set over time. Are the numbers going up or are they going down? How much are they going up? How much are they going down? And in order for the numbers within the data set to have integrity, the calculation of the numbers, the methodology for calculating the numbers has to be identical every year. We fortunately have data sets that are 42 years old that have used the identical methodology for calculating the data over every one of those years. And so we're doing some really interesting stuff with algorithms and AI to try to interpret predictive data from our data sets. And we just finished up the NACA Land Index, and we'll be publishing that very shortly, where we have looked at 42 years of land sales in Manhattan, south of 96th Street, 2,444 transactions. We've analyzed, we've disaggregated it into five buckets: residential rental land, condo land, hotel, office, and a miscellaneous bucket. And we've compared the fluctuations in the values within each of those buckets to a basket of macroeconomic factors: interest rates, inflation, lending rates, S&P 500, Dow Jones Industrial Average, price of gold, price of oil, you name it, and looking for correlation between a macroeconomic factor and the way the market has moved. And it could be one factor, it could be a basket of factors, but it's fascinating stuff. And because of the integrity within our data set, we think that it is going to provide some predictive analysis about the way different macroeconomic factors are either lead indicators or lagging indicators of the way land values are going to fluctuate. So this is the kind of stuff we're doing with AI that, you know, I never had this conversation with you 5 years ago. It would have sounded like hocus pocus, but really is tremendously interesting stuff.
Well, before we get into the New York specific questions and some of those about those sales being leading indicators, I do want to ask, with kind of that funnel and conversion and the data and tech, I could obviously see how those can be influenced by technology, but do you think there's anything in our business that won't be?
You know, a lot of people talk about AI replacing people. I think in certain industries, certain types of businesses, yes, AI will replace people. But I think in real estate, people who use AI will replace people who don't use AI, but I don't believe that AI will replace the human element, mainly because buildings are not widgets. Every building is different. And oddly enough, every square foot is different. So with that being the case, how can you possibly have algorithms that can equate one thing to another or take that human element out when you have an industry where really nothing is standardized?
Excellent. So, Bob, I do want to talk about the New York market in particular. And I think there are some obvious reasons that New York is special, but are there any not obvious reasons that make New York so different to work in than any other major market in the U.S.?
No, well, New York is great. I think one of the things that always strikes me about New York is the massive size of it. And I think that there are two philosophies that you can have in life about the way you go about things. One is that the world is a zero-sum game. And a win for you is a loss for me, so I don't want you to ever win. The other philosophy is an abundance mentality where, hey, Cole, you just won. Good for you. I'm going to go get my win now because there's enough to go around for everybody. And in a market where you have 176,000 investment properties, there's enough to go around for everybody. And so that's one of the aspects of the market that I really love is there's always another piece of business. And also, I really like the investment sales world because we co-broke with each other a lot. We're friends. I'm friendly with just about every sales broker in New York. And that I really like, you know, as opposed to the mortgage brokerage business where mortgage brokers detest each other. They never co-broke. They never work together. So it's totally a zero-sum game kind of thing. And so that's one aspect of the market I really love. Plus, it's a market where, you know, you could have the biggest piece of junk property in the world. It could have environmental problems. It could be falling apart. It could have hair growing out of it. And there'll be 100 people that are dying to buy it. Where, you know, in some markets, you can have really great quality buildings. And it's tough to find a buyer with a pair of binoculars and a couple of Sherpas. We're very lucky that demand is so great in New York. And, you know, so there are a number of things that I really love about the city.
So you've experienced a lot of different market cycles in New York. How about you kind of ground us and tell us where you think we are right now?
I think that we're in uncharted territory. During every market correction we've had, every property type was losing value just to varying degrees. Today, we have a market, and it's been like this for a couple of years now, where different market segments are going in different directions. We have a retail market that started to get negatively impacted years before anything else. Retail market's very strong right now. Retail leasing activity's picking up. Rents have stopped going down. Investor demand is back. It's a very strong market segment. The hotel market, absolutely on fire today. 30,000 rooms taken out of circulation for conversion or other uses. And we have a prohibition, essentially a prohibition on building new hotels. Very challenging to do that. So the hotel market's on fire. The industrial market is still strong. Our land market is doing well. And then you look at our two biggest markets, office and multifamily, they are both reacting like the broader market and that different sectors are going in different directions. In office, Class A new construction doing tremendously well. Tremendous tenant demand and everything is going great. But in the B and C office, we're still trying to find our footing. I'd seen every time for the past 9 months, every time we thought the market had bottomed out, there's a new transaction at an even lower price per foot. And then in the multifamily market, you know, Class A or free market units doing very well. Our politicians who all say they want to make New York City more affordable for everybody. And most of the things they've done is made New York less affordable for everybody. So we have a supply constraint market. Our tax abatement, the 485X tax abatement for new construction is absolutely ineffective and terrible. So we're not getting enough supply being added. So free market rents are going through the roof. Consequently, cap rates on free market buildings are dropping like a stone, which is great. But on the other side of the table, you have our rent stabilized housing stock, which is suffering tremendously. Values are down 50 to 75%. We have a lot of zombie buildings in the market. So our turnover rate is very, very low today. Generally for the marketplace, it's operating at 1.8%. relative to that 2.6% average. The reason it's so low is because most of the buildings in New York are multifamily and the rent stabilized stuff is not trading because that stock of buildings is basically a ton of zombie buildings. There's no equity in them. The bank doesn't want the building. The owner doesn't want the building. Nobody has incentive to invest in it. And the politicians created that. And so that is creating a big drag. At some point, I think if Mamdani gets elected, I think it'll be the final nail in the coffin for those buildings and probably the final nail in the coffin for some lenders that have lent a lot on that kind of stock of buildings. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, but doesn't look promising at this point. So how is the market? You have to talk about specific market segments, but going in different directions at the same time, which we've never seen before. So we're in uncharted territory.
We're sitting here on October 24th, just a couple weeks from Election Day. It looks as if Zoran Mamdani is going to become mayor, barring some sort of major catastrophe. But what do you think that's going to mean for New York City's housing supply? And I know, ironically, somewhat, Andrew Cuomo happens to be the governor that signed that 2019 law that put us in part of this position, too. So where do you see this shaking out?
Yeah, well, again, you have to look at market sectors specifically. To the extent that you're talking about the rent-stabilized housing market, Mamdani has pledged a rent freeze for 4 years, which is actually very interesting that he would say that publicly, because that's against the law. The law says that the rent increases are supposed to be based on inflation. So unless he's a mentalist and can see into the future and knows how prices are going to be affected and everything, to say, I'm going to disregard the law, break the law, and just freeze rents because I'll get more votes, that seems a little crazy. But the mayor does control the Rent Guidelines Board. And although the Rent Guidelines Board sets the increases, he does control who sits on the board. So, you know, we'll see. It could be very, very bad for that stock. You know, 80% of what he talks about, he has absolutely no control over or influence over at state legislature stuff. But it'll be very interesting to see, you know, how that plays out. I've also heard from some folks in his camp that he's very anti-union, that he believes unions are very corrupt, which could be good for the housing market, for the new construction housing.
Sure.
485X is so ineffective. The politicians tried to tie minimum wages to the tax abatements in Zone A. You build over 150 units, you have to pay a $72 minimum wage. And that's crazy. And so it's not feasible to build.
Going to get a lot of 149-unit buildings under that policy.
Yeah, and a lot of 90. If you go over 100 units, it's $40 minimum wage. So there are no minimum wages under 100 units, which is why 32 of the 35 building permits that have been issued in the city since 485X came into being are for under 100 units. People now are spending more time figuring out how to subdivide a site up into various pads on which they can build 99 units rather than building one big building, which is more efficient and for a variety of reasons is better. But our policymakers don't use common sense.
So let's put Bob Nackle into the position of land use policymaker. What would be a few key changes you would make to improve the investment environment right now?
Yeah, very easy. Very easy. Number one, probably the most impactful, would be to reinstitute or reconstitute the major capital improvement program and the individual apartment improvement program in New York. I'll take you back to 1978. The housing supply was in horrible condition. 14% of the units were deemed uninhabitable because they were in such bad condition. That was a 14%, what they referred to as the dilapidation rate. And 1978, the Yankees were playing the Dodgers in the World Series. The Goodyear blimp is above Yankee Stadium, and it pans out. And the
Paris Bronx is burning.
Yeah, six fires going on within three blocks of Yankee Stadium, and Howard Cosell famously says the Bronx is burning. Why was the Bronx burning? Because it made more sense to burn your building down than to invest in it. And so we had the city smartly put the major capital improvement program into effect, MCI, and the individual apartment improvement program into effect, IAI. That returned a 30% return to owners who invested in their buildings in the form of increased rents. And so what happened? Well, the private sector does what they always do. They reacted to good incentives, and they dumped tens of billions of dollars into the housing stock. So in 2019, that 14% dilapidation rate had dropped to 0.04%. And what do these knuckleheads do? They marginalize both of those programs such that there is no incentive to invest in the housing stock today. When a rent-stabilized apartment that was renting for $700 a month that's worth $4,000 a month on the open market becomes vacant, the owners don't rent it to $768. they nail it shut. And so it's estimated that we have between 60 and 80,000 of these apartments sitting vacant. So what I would do is I would immediately say, I'm restoring the MCI and the IAI programs. And you know what? Within 2 weeks, 60 to 80,000 apartments would be under gut renovation. How much sheetrock are you going to sell? How many fixtures? How many appliances? How many sinks and bathtubs and toilets and refrigerators? How much of this stuff are you going to sell? And how economically stimulative would that be? And how much would that added supply to the market exert downward pressure on rents that New Yorkers are facing? Without hurting a single tenant, because these units are already vacant.
And they're already empty, yeah.
I would look at the 485X program, say, you know what, nice try, we can't please everybody. Labor should get behind changes as well, because although the minimum wages are very high, you're getting a fraction of the jobs you could get if you had a decent abatement program. I'd go back to the old original 421A. It worked very well for a long time, and I'd reinstitute that. The solution to all of our housing problems are on the supply side. You know, I did my walking tour of Manhattan, walked every block. I was shocked that public housing has a lot coverage of about 12%, whereas private sector housing has a lot coverage of 70%. Where housing on publicly owned land in the city, just in prime Manhattan, south of 96th Street, the city owns 196 acres of land.
And there's a lot of surface parking lots, too. So it's incredible.
And on that 196 acres, they have 30 million feet of housing with 15 million feet of air rights. All of that land is very poorly and inadequately zoned, even if it just got up to a 10 FAR. Which is very reasonable for a lot of it is waterfront property.
Yeah.
Have 60 million feet of air rights. Knock all this stuff down, build properties 100 feet away from where the existing buildings are. Tell people, hey, look, sorry. Yes, I'm going to displace you. You have to go all the way 100 feet over to a brand new building, the same size apartment, pay the same rent, but the building's not going to be falling down all around you. Then I would do 100 of these developments at the same time. He would solve all of our housing problems. There's such easy fixes that is such commonsensical, but nobody has the political will to do it because you have to tell somebody, hey, you have to move 100 feet to go over there. And oh gosh, I might not get reelected. That's the biggest problem we have in New York is that I think most people realize that supply is the solution to all of our problems, but yet every politician only cares about getting reelected. When you say, oh, yeah, I know I need more supply, but more supply, that new building, that's going to bring new people into my district that don't know me and might not vote for me. So there's no way I want that to happen. That is a conflict of interest. And so that has to be solved.
And there's a bit of irony there, too, because if rents are super high, then I'm out competing somebody who might have otherwise lived in that apartment forever. So I think it's extremely complicated, but rather it's not complicated. It seems like the solution's right there in front of us, but I totally get it.
You gotta have the political will to do it.
So, Bob, one more kind of New York specific question. You look at land and development site activity every day, and you've written a lot about how that serves as a leading indicator. What are you seeing there right now?
I see positive trends. I think that if you look at land values historically, the peak of every cycle has greatly exceeded the prior peak. We're not at that point yet. So I think we're at the beginning stages of what's going to see a big escalation in land values. Certainly land value increases have not kept up with condo pricing increases or rent increases. So I think the sky is very, very blue for land values moving forward. We just need a tax abatement program that makes sense. You can't appease everybody. You can't say, well, we want to make this group happy and that group happy and every group happy. Otherwise, we're not going to do it. You know what? You need to solve the affordability problem in the city. Building supply is the way to do that. Look, during the pandemic, even if you're one of these elected officials that believes that an Econ 101 textbook is capitalist propaganda, you can't dispute the fact that during the pandemic, vacancy soared in Manhattan. Rents went down by 30%. There is not a housing policy that's been implemented anywhere in the United States that made rents go down by 5%. So all you have to do is build your way out of it. But we need a political system that will allow people or force people to create the housing stock that we need.
Bob, do you think there will be anything about this kind of upcoming or the cycle that we're currently in that will surprise people?
I think it's TBD. I think we have to see the Mamdani effect, what's going to happen with crime, what's going to happen with the flow of capital. One interesting thing is that even a lot of people in the real estate industry misconstrue what impacts cap rates. Cap rates impact value. People mistakenly think that interest rates are highly correlated to cap rates. That's not the case. Cap rates are more highly correlated to the flow of capital. For instance, if I handed you $3 billion of equity, Cole, and said, go buy apartment buildings in Chelsea, I guarantee you, regardless of what the interest rate environment is, cap rates in Chelsea are going to go way down.
Yeah.
It's about the flow of capital. And a lot of people are saying, hey, if this guy gets elected, I'm pulling out of Manhattan. I'm not deploying capital into Manhattan or New York City. That's bad for the city. So we have to see. Those are two big things to keep an eye on. What's going to happen with crime? What's going to happen with the flow of capital? And, we'll see what happens.
Now, do you think there's a common belief about the New York real estate market that folks have wrong? Anything you feel like you're out on an island on?
No, I think that my bottom line is always never bet against New York. As I've seen several times where people said, oh, New York is done, it's over. And at some point it will be over. It's not lost on me that, every great civilization over the course of human history has been dominant for a period of time and then lost its dominant position. So I think New York is the capital of the world. It's the greatest city in the world. At some point, it won't be. It's just a question of how long we can hang on and don't know what it's going to be that will ultimately take New York down. But I don't think it's a four-year stint with someone who's not ideal for business or real estate that is going to do New York in.
And without showing my cards here, it's not the first bad mayor that we've had here. I got one more question for you, and we ask this to all our guests. If you could snap your fingers and have any change to our industry come true, what would it be?
Interesting question. Change to the industry. No, I don't know. I mean, selfishly and myopically, I think policy change for our housing market, I think it's so important. There are so many people who are kind of forgotten about within our society in New York, mainly the people who really make the city run, the policemen, the firemen, the teachers, people who work in bakeries and delis and things like that. I mean, for these folks to have to commute an hour and a half from Pennsylvania or, far away from the city makes no sense. There should be adequate housing for them, adequate housing for people up and down the socioeconomic ladder. And so if there was any change, I wish I could modify the housing policy such that New York was more livable for people who really make the city run.
Well, Bob, I know we could probably talk for another few hours, but glad I got a chance to talk to you today. I think that's all the time we've got. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. And best of luck to everybody out there.
And big thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.